Welcome to another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast, a production of the Criminal Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School in Charlottesville, Virginia. Every 2 weeks, we release a new episode. Today, we're going to have a conversation about a recent opinion from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Please note that these episodes may contain facts and circumstances surrounding criminal trials. Listener discretion is advised.
Rise! Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America at this moment.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Criminal Law Presents CAF Chats. Today we're going to talk about the March 4, 2024 decision from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces in the United States versus Driscoll. I am Major Dustin Morgan and I'm joined here today with
Lieutenant Colonel Rick Matthew.
Sir, first time on the PAC podcast. Welcome. We're glad to have you.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here. I'm told I'm not allowed to make jokes, so that's right. Unfortunate.
That's right, sir. This is a joke-free podcast. All serious business all the time.
Okay.
So again, we're going to talk about United States versus Driscoll today, a case involving double jeopardy in the bars against successive prosecutions. So do you want to tell us a little bit about the facts in Driscoll?
Okay. So Driscoll, obviously a case about double jeopardy, entails two different courts martial. So Driscoll he's an Air Force guy, and his family consists of him, his wife, and his young daughter. While they're in Italy in 2018, Driscoll goes to his wife and says, "I need to tell you something. I have a need to look at child pornography." And the wife says, "Well, that's unfortunate. So I'm going to ask you to stop that. I need you to delete some stuff." And so, but she does not report him. Later in that same month, in 2018, in March, his three-year-old daughter is diagnosed with herpes. And so, unusual for a child to get herpes. And so, there's an investigation that kicks off. And as a result of the investigation, his digital media is searched and they find, importantly for this case, they find obscene cartoons. So, cartoons that depict child sexual assault. So as the investigation's going on, his wife and daughter go back to Texas. So they leave Italy and they go back to Texas. And then shortly thereafter, presumably the investigation completes and Driscoll is tried by judge alone. I'll call Driscoll one. Now there's not a second. There's not multiple appellate opinions here, but what we would call Driscoll one here, he's tried by judge alone for a few charges. And one of them includes a charge related to the obscene cartoons depicting child sexual assault. So the way that it was charged in that case was that it was charged as a violation of Article 134 UCMJ. If we recall Article 134 UCMJ, there's three ways that we can charge that. So first, we can charge it as something that's prejudicial to good order and discipline. Second, we can charge it as something that's of a nature to bring discredit upon the armed services. Or third, we can charge it as what we sometimes call, what do we call it?
It's like the extraterritorial application of the UCMJ.
Yeah, or just basically incorporating federal law. So we might say simulative crimes or something along those lines, but essentially incorporating a federal or even possibly a state law if it's happening on a federal installation, something along those lines. But he's charged under that Clause 3, where he's charged as a violation of 18 USC. And if we hear 18 USC, of course, we're thinking we're outside of 10 USC. We're in the federal crimes part of U.S. statutes. And so he's charged as a violation of 18 USC, and it's important to consider what he was charged with there. So during this first trial, he is tried by judge alone, and at the closing arguments, the defense counsel during arguments says, "Hey, Your Honor, in the course of closing arguments, this charge was erroneously drafted. The government is not going to be able to prove basically one of the elements," but they really talk almost and probably in a way that's geared towards jurisdiction. So under 18 USC and the specific statute, that's not really totally relevant to go through all the nuances. What it required is, if when we usually have federal crimes, there's usually some type of what we would call like a federal hook or a nexus, right? So a lot of us are used to hearing cases or elements of charges where they say it's something moved in interstate commerce or interstate transport to help give it that federal connection. And that particular aspect of the charges that he was charged with under federal law did have that, did have a interstate commerce aspect, or it could have had, on the other end, it could have had that it happened on federal land, right? So, and what the defense counsel was recognizing was that the government had failed to meet that and couldn't meet that because this was happening in Italy and not on the base. And so there was no way that the government was going to get to a place to be able to prove that it happened on exclusive or concurrent federal jurisdiction. And so they made that argument during their closing arguments. The judge then says, of her own volition, sua sponte, says, oh, so you're asking to dismiss this charge. This sounds like a motion to dismiss. And so the judge asks for both sides to provide briefings. And eventually the judge dismisses this case for a lack of jurisdiction. So says essentially that there's just no way that you could get to a place where this is happening in Italy, and there's no way that you get to a place where he'd be found guilty of that specification. And so therefore there's a lack of jurisdiction. And we can get into a little bit later about why the judge might have said that. But Driscoll is also found not guilty of the other specifications against him. And so he walks away from this court martial clean. One specification related to those cartoons is dismissed without prejudice, by the way. Dismissed without prejudice because the judge says, hey, there's other ways that this could have been proven. The judge sort of alluding to what does eventually happen. And so Driscoll walks away. Driscoll then goes to visit his wife and child in the States. And after his visit, his child makes an outcry that he had sexually assaulted her. And that kicks off what we would call Driscoll 2, or really the case that we're at right now, which is a case where Driscoll was charged with a number of sexual assault allegations against his daughter, and also recharged with the possession of those obscene cartoons. And in this case, he's now charged under Clause 2, which is to say that rather than it being a violation of federal law, it was of a nature to bring discredit upon the armed forces.
Yeah, and the way I teach 134, when we talk about 134 here at the schoolhouse, is those sections of the UCMJ are kind of choose your own adventure. So in Clause 1 and Clause 2, arguably, you can charge a lot of different things as long as they're either A, prejudicial to good order and discipline, or B, services crediting like the government charged here. So interesting they brought it back under that section of Article 134.
And so now he's at his second court-martial, and what Driscoll actually ends up doing is that he enters into a plea agreement with the government and agrees to plead guilty to that offense, not to the offenses against his daughter, but to the possession of those obscene cartoons, but preserves his right to make a double jeopardy claim. And so it's really a question about whether or not he was under jeopardy and whether double jeopardy attached as it relates to these two offenses, the first offense being one where he was tried under Clause 3 of Article 134, the federal law, and then later being tried under Clause 2 of Article 134.
And he enters into this guilty plea, it seems like, sir, after he kind of made his pitch to the trial level court. He filed a motion with the judge saying, hey, you should dismiss this because I've already been tried for this before. The judge disagrees with that assessment, citing the prior judge's opinion in Driscoll 1, where she says on the record, subsequent prosecutions are not barred. She doesn't really do much of a double jeopardy analysis, but she says that before dismissing the specification. He even files a writ in Driscoll 2, so asking for some sort of extraordinary relief to the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, being like, hey, I'm being unjustly tried. I have no other recourse, but the Air Force Court disagrees with him that they have writ jurisdiction. Basically because they are like, we can deal with this during the course of ordinary appeals. Like, we can look at this after you're convicted if you are. So that kind of bars you from filing a writ in most circumstances. So interesting procedural posture. He's like, I'll plead guilty, but I'm still preserving this for appeal. So obviously it gets its way up to CAFSTER. What happens once CAF gets a hold of this? What do they have to say about the double jeopardy issue?
So CAF is having to deal with the double jeopardy issue. And when we talk about double jeopardy, remember, we're really talking about, can someone be tried twice for the same offense? And there's constitutional UCMJ and RCM protections against that, but they all amount to that same basic question. And so first, the question we have to deal with, was he actually tried twice and did jeopardy attach? So just something, you know, good to kind of know is that in our system, jeopardy attaches in a judge alone case, which is what Driscoll 1 was, right? We really want to question about what happened in Driscoll 1 when there's a presentation of evidence. And so presumably we were at closing arguments, which means certainly there was a presentation of evidence as it relates to that Clause 3 offense that was charged in Driscoll 1. And there cannot be jeopardy if the court does not have jurisdiction. So that might be, you know, sort of the question that might next be raised. And that is sort of what the trial judge in Driscoll 1 was thinking about when they looked at that charge and said, well, there is a lack of jurisdiction. And so, but the CAF says, no, that's incorrect. There was jurisdiction. So personal jurisdiction and subject matter jurisdiction get us to jurisdiction over the offense and the offender. And we had those, right? So Driscoll's a member of the armed forces. There was never a question about that. So personal jurisdiction was never really at issue. And then subject matter jurisdiction. And so though it's true that he could never have been found guilty of violating this law in Italy off base, presuming that they're not going in the interstate commerce sort of route, because it just he's just not factually there, that doesn't take away subject matter jurisdiction. Subject matter jurisdiction says the UCMJ applies to us in all places, and he was in a place. And so certainly the place where this happened doesn't, you know, change the fact that he could have been found to have jurisdiction. It just never was going to happen in the way that it was charged.
And it's interesting, too. I think some of the confusion comes from the fact that Title 18 of the U.S. Code talks about these interstate or federal exclusive jurisdiction areas as like a jurisdictional element.
Yeah, and that's something that the court talks about. So it's sort of unfortunate that the way that the federal law, the way that they talk about some of those, what, you know, I call it like a federal hook almost, right? It's not really about jurisdiction. It's really about how can Congress have the authority to make a law about something that probably normally falls to the states. And it's when they find that federal hook, when they say that you're moving in between states or you're affecting commerce or it's happening on federal jurisdiction. And so the shorthand that we use, unfortunately, is jurisdiction, but we shouldn't be calling it a jurisdictional element because it truly isn't a jurisdictional element. It's just an element, right. Really. Right. And so so the problem here is that when the judge was looking at jurisdiction, the judge should have just looked at literally, do we have personal and subject matter jurisdiction? And we do. And then did the government meet all the elements would have been the real question. And so CAF says, listen, in Driscoll 1, there definitely was jurisdiction. And so we don't have a problem there. And then the last question that we have to deal with is it truly the same offense? And so CAF goes into a look at our Supreme Court case and a CAF case. So the Supreme Court case is Blockberger. And what Blockberger says is that you're basically going to look at the two different, right? If we're looking at a double jeopardy situation, look at the two different specifications and ask ourselves, is there whether each provision, right, each specification requires proof of a fact which the other does not. So if there's something different between specification from the first one and specification from the second one, and there's just like a Venn diagram that doesn't perfectly overlap, then it would not be the same offense. That makes sense, and that's good. But then the CAF in 2020 came with a case called Rice, where they essentially said, look, we agree and we're fine with the fact that, yes, in 134 offenses, yeah, that's an element, right? A jurisdictional element that we call it, the interstate commerce and all that other stuff, get it, it's an element. But they basically said, we don't care, essentially, and said, we think that that's such a nitinoid little thing, so we're not going to allow that to be the thing that causes something to not pass the Blockberger test. And so they essentially said, we don't believe that Congress intended Article 134 to allow for re-prosecution under Title 18 criminal offenses just by removing, again, they use that word jurisdictional element, but maybe it's a better course of action to call it that federal hook, right? So the Blockberger test is really getting at, is there a difference between the two things? And what they're saying is, while this might be an element, there's not really a difference.
Right, because absent Rice, I mean, this analysis seems pretty easy. And the first time in Driscoll 1, he was charged under Title 18, and they had to prove either interstate commerce or exclusive federal jurisdiction. You remove that in Driscoll 2 when you put Clause 2, the of a nature to bring discredit upon the armed forces. different elements, but like you said, sir, essentially the same offense, just under a different name, more or less.
And so now we're really squarely in that same place as Rice. And it's a very unique set of circumstances. It's probably not going to happen too often. And even the Rice court said, we're not sure that this is going to carry forward. And lo and behold, military justice practitioners found a way to do it again. And so here we are. And so the court said, yes, Jeopardy did attach. It was there was jurisdiction and it was the same offense. And so therefore, the government was barred from bringing this specification under Double Jeopardy.
So what's the ultimate result here? Given that analysis, what happens in Driscoll?
They basically, I mean, look, that charge is going away. Driscoll's found guilty of child sexual assault for a couple specifications and is getting decades in jail. And so I think it went back to the Air Force, who's going to go back and, you know, reassess sentence and things along those lines. You're the appellate guy, you tell me.
So under Winkleman, which is another case from CAF, the Courts of Criminal Appeals can reassess the sentence and they look at their experience on the bench. They look at what similar offenses get. And so they'll take the, you know, the 30 years, like you said, that he got for the two counts of child sexual assault and see whether or not possessing the obscene images is going to change that punitive landscape in a meaningful way. My guess is that it will not change it significantly, and Driscoll will still spend a significant amount of time in prison.
It's not going to do anything.
Right, more or less. Not going to do a thing. He's probably still going to get 30 years ultimately. So you've said this is kind of like a niche issue where we've, you know, waited. Rice was 2020. It was only 4 years again before something similar happened. But what can the field take away from a case like this? What should the field be looking out for?
Yeah, even if a case is a niche issue, that doesn't mean you can't learn something from it. There's no case that I've ever read that I haven't learned something from. So here's some takeaways for me for Driscoll. So first, you have to understand when Jeopardy attaches, and that goes for both the government and the defense. So the attachment of Jeopardy can just mean a lot of things, but it can really mean what happens if this case blows up, or if we try to blow up the case, where are we at on coming back? And so from the government's perspective, once Jeopardy attaches, right, they need to know, okay, I've impaneled in a panel case, or I have presented evidence in a judge alone case. I need to now protect this case because I might not be able to come back short of a mistrial or something along those lines. If something else happens, I got to make sure that I do everything I can to protect the case. And in the defense side, same thing. Hey, maybe I need to wait. Maybe I need to lurk and wait until Jeopardy is attached before I raise sort of an issue that doesn't rise to something like jurisdiction, but does rise to a failing of the government. And that's strategy, but you can't start strategy unless you know, right? Unless you've thought about that. And so that's important. The second thing I'd sort of cite here is that counsel need to understand what they're asking the court to do and to not necessarily allow the court to, you know, sort of respectfully, but not necessarily allow the court to bowl them over. And so the defense counsel in Driscoll 1 was sitting there and saying, hey, listen, let me explain to you why my client's not guilty. And one of the reasons why they're not guilty is because the government doesn't really even know how to write their own charges, and they charge something that they're never going to be able to prove. They're never going to be able to prove. They did not prove that he was on a federal installation. And the judge, sua sponte, recharacterizes that argument as a motion to dismiss, and that's not great for the defense.
Yeah, right? There's a strong argument here that Driscoll would have been better off just being found not guilty at that first court-martial.
In the end, this ended up being okay, but if there, you know, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, right? And so I'd probably want to have a finding of not guilty rather than having a dismissal without prejudice.
Right.
That doesn't necessarily stop something else from happening, but that finding of not guilty, it certainly is helpful. And so, but of course, you know, he's the counsel and it was tough to probably talk the judge down. So the last takeaway for me is preserving your case intelligently. And so Driscoll, when we come to Driscoll 2, Driscoll files motions to dismiss for double jeopardy and even tries a writ, as you talked about. But most importantly, he doesn't fight till the end. And so he eventually pleads guilty to it because he probably recognizes that that's his really only way to get around this, is to say that there's double jeopardy, that's going to be the legal argument is what's going to carry the day for him to get away from this. And he got something for it. Case does explain that the convening authority approved waiver of forfeitures and probably got some benefit to his family, who he may still presumably have affinity for. And so there was no reason for him to necessarily fight, but he still preserved it, right? And so it comes back on appeal. Now, of course, he has bigger fish to fry with the decades of jail that he's going to face for the child sexual assault. But in a different circumstances, you can see where it might behoove a defense counsel to come in and say, let me plead guilty to something. Let me see what I can get out of it while trying to preserve some appellate rights. Difficult to do in the Army system, certainly, because it will require coordination with some pretty high folks because there's a lot of moving parts with something like that.
Right. It's rare to not waive an appellate issue like this during a guilty plea. It definitely takes some higher authorization than we're allowed to do at the field level. So you're right, sir. They are rare, but they do happen from time to time.
And even without that type of situation, you could also see a circumstance where the defense comes in and says, we'll plead naked, meaning we'll plead without the benefit of a pretrial agreement. And so the benefit they get there is that now they're not waiving any type of motion or all the things that they've held over for appellate review. And they are also getting a little bit of maybe love from the judge, right? To say, hey, look at the character of the accused to say, I'm owning up to what I did without that benefit, right? So another option can be out there.
Right. Anything else, sir, before we wrap this one up?
No, I think that that's about it.
Well, as always, we thank you for listening. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and rate us 5 stars. Thanks again, sir.
Thank you. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks for joining us today for another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast. If anything you heard sparked a thought, we'd love to connect with you. Your comments help us create better future content for the field or the fleet. Reach out to us on Facebook or Instagram. The information can be found in the show notes for today's episode. The views expressed in today's podcast are those of the presenters and not necessarily the Judge Advocate General's or the Department of the Army or the Department of Defense.
Thanks, counsel, for both sides. And the court will stand in recess until further order of the court.